Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of 2009. We're happy to have with us this hour the Associate Editor of Astronomy Magazine, Daniel Pendick, is here. Astronomy is a wonderful magazine, the world's most complete when it comes to astronomy, and it's published right here in Wisconsin. They have the top 10 stories of 2008 featured in the current issue, the January issue of Astronomy Magazine, and also they're looking ahead headlines that we'll be seeing in this new year, which is the International Year of Astronomy. The global celebration aims to stimulate greater interest in astronomy and in science. NASA's spacecraft will fly by Mars in February for a gravity boost en route to its rendezvous with asteroids. And we'll talk about that. It's also launching a test prototype of the Ares 1 launch vehicle. And, well, there are all kinds of things, searching for extra solar planets the size of Earth and smaller. That's going to be launched in June. So we'll look at the big stories of 2008 and what we can look forward to in the year 2009, this hour of our program with Daniel. And welcome your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Daniel, Happy New Year, and thank you so much for being with us on this New Year Day.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, nice to have you here. One of the big stories, and I don't know if you list this as number one, I know you have one through ten, but this story of astronomers hearing a star's death gasp for the first time, and the fact that this happened just in a way serendipitously, didn't it?
It did. You know, they just happened to be looking at another supernova that had gone off, I think, maybe about 10 days earlier. Had the NASA Swiss satellite pointed in the right direction, and the thing to realize is that in the real sky, a galaxy like that is just a tiny sliver of the sky, and you'd have a hard time finding it with just an ordinary telescope. And for another supernova, especially a very bright one, to go off right in the field, it's pretty rare. I believe the chance of that happening at that moment was something about 1 in 10,000. If I remember
right. Oh my gosh. So it was meant to happen. For us, it was meant to happen, right?
I guess so. Well, yeah. Alicia Soderbergh, the one who picked it up, she said that I truly won the astronomy lottery. So she's a young scientist and earlier in her career, so she owes someone up there something.
Yeah, right. What exactly is a supernova, Daniel?
Okay. Well, basically, when you have a massive star, more massive than our sun, it burns fuel for a number of years, and then the core becomes, in a way, kind of unstable. It can't support the pressure anymore coming in on it. It collapses, and there's kind of a rebound shock. Hmm. The shock wave bursts back out and tears the star apart, and the debris flies outward for many years and gives off different kinds of energy, but that exact moment, you know, was new. It occurred, but we sort of came in late in the game, usually. And by the time it was visible in the sky, it had already happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they saw. It just happened to be in the right place at the right time to see that go off.
Yeah. And how have we been able to capture images of these supernova in space?
Well, they used various techniques. I mean, the classical way in history has been visible light. I mean, like 4 centuries ago, for example, Tycho Brahe, a very famous astronomer, he and other people saw a star suddenly brighten, and that's really the definition of a nova or a supernova. A star just suddenly becomes tremendously brighter. We didn't really know what they were. So that's visual observations, and that's usually where we would pick them up. And then they would start observing in other wavelengths, you know, X-rays and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's the big supernova surveys. They rely on robotic telescopes that search the sky and look for that sudden brightening. They see sort of a before and after, a star they've observed before. Then they see it suddenly brighten, and then that tells us a supernova has happened.
Hmm. And will something like that happen to us eventually, to Earth?
No. Now, our sun will basically, it's not massive enough to go through the supernova. So it'll go through various phases of aging, become what they call a red giant. Its outer atmosphere will expand tremendously. That'll consume the inner planets. And then that'll cool down, and eventually it'll become what they call a white dwarf. And it'll just slowly cool down and wink out of existence. Don't worry too much about it. It's another 6 billion years or so. So you know,
okay,
don't
I guess
your life insurance policy, I guess.
And how in the world do we know it's 6 billion years away?
Well, what they do is, you know, from studying stars for so long, basically it's kind of amazing. But you know, based on what a star is made of, its mass, things like that, you can sort of just crank through the physics and predict what basically must happen based on the laws of physics. And it really depends on a lot on the mass. How big is this thing? And that determines its fate to a large degree.
Hmm. What did we learn about Mars last year, Daniel?
Well, well, Phoenix Lander, you know, the reason it went there is to sort of, it wasn't to look at life, which I think some people misunderstood. It was to look at the habitability of the northern polar region for life, you know, the environment itself.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing we confirmed is we actually got some actual water for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we sort of knew it was there, but there's a big difference between sort of knowing it's there and actually getting it into a laboratory instrument, you know, and saying, okay, we've got water.
Mm-hmm.
And based on testing it, the idea was to try to find out if it was very ancient water. You know, has it been there for a long time? And found some other things, some chemicals in the soil that told us that, you know, liquid water was there because these minerals only form in water. Found a chemical called perchlorate, which is can be a nasty substance.
Hmm.
It's used to make fireworks and rocket fuel.
Hmm.
But at the same time, it's also true that they found bacteria that can basically eat the stuff on Earth. So one other thing we found is, I think, kind of a science-weeny thing, but, you know, earlier on the rovers had found that soils farther toward the equator were very acidic. And we found out the soil in the northern polar region is alkaline. And I think the take-home message there is that every time you launch a lander and you taste a little bit of Mars, it's just specific to that region. You know, there's a variety of environments, and you can't really take one test and apply it to the whole planet.
Oh, that's
sort of gives you hope that there's, you know, a variety of environments up there that might have been kind of conducive to life.
Huh. That the Phoenix Lander has done quite a job, hasn't it?
Well, yeah. You know, if I could just tell you a little bit of the background on that.
Sure.
You know, why this was a sort of significant event is more than just the science. I mean, one thing, when I talk to people about this, is just to realize that we basically took a fully equipped science laboratory, something you'd find on a benchtop, and we flew it, you know, 170 million miles.
Yeah.
We landed it. It didn't blow up. It worked.
Yeah.
And that's a great achievement. And then you look at what happened to the earlier sort of version of Phoenix. The reason it's called Phoenix, that's sort of the mythical bird that rises out of its ashes. The technology they used to land it didn't quite work in 1999. In fact, its predecessor, the Mars Polar Lander, it probably made a nice crater on the surface. It had a total failure there. So this was the first time since Viking in the mid to late 70s that we've landed a fairly heavy, you know, lander on Mars using rocket thrusters. So just to give you an idea of what we were up against here, the NASA people call it the 7 minutes of terror. The ship comes in after being in space for years, maybe, about 13,000 miles per hour, right?
Goodness.
Its heat shield breaks it from that to 900 miles per hour as it burns up. Then it parachutes to 250 miles an hour in about 15 seconds.
Mm.
So that's sort of a supersonic drag chute. Then at 3,200 feet, it lets go and it just starts to fall. That's about two times the height of the Empire State Building. Then by the time it figures out it's pointing in the right direction, it fires its thrusters, and then it sort of touches down on the surface. And all that happens in 7 minutes. And it's, you can imagine the forces and the temperatures that you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a great relief to the scientists, you know, holding their breath, because the last time, they say E.T. didn't phone home. So I think as an engineering, you know, trick, it's pretty amazing, really, that we, you know, NASA people are really, honestly, they're the best in the business, so it's impressive.
It is impressive. You think about what happened and how far it is, and you just go, oh, my gosh, I can't believe we can do that. I can't believe it. Now, there's something going on this year. Tell me about what's happening with the NASA's Dawn spacecraft. That's going by Mars, isn't it, next month?
Yes. That is the first mission to the asteroid, the belt, and it gets an assist from Mars. It sort of uses its gravity, kind of dives in. You have to kind of imagine it like, I don't know if you've ever seen those competition skateboarders, and they sort of go to the top of a wall, and they skate down, and they fly up in the air the other side.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of what Dawn's going to do, get a sort of, let's say, fall down into the gravity well of Mars, fly out the other side, and that'll give it enough of a boost to get to where it needs to go. And it's going to visit a couple of asteroids, really big ones, Vesta and Ceres. Vesta in 2011, and Ceres in 2015. And that'll be our, you know, that's the first. Although we have actually come up pretty close to a few asteroids, this will be the first mission to that part of the solar system. It's pretty far out there between Mars and Jupiter.
And it'll send us back pictures of this, or what?
Pictures, and it'll really, you know, on the science side, it wants to sort of study them and see what they're made of, and see if there's water, ice on them, and things like that. You know, they're sort of time capsules. You know, they form very, very early in the solar system, and that'll give us kind of a look at what the solar system is made out of.
Mm-hmm. And will we learn anything about those that may come to Earth? Is there any mission that's looking at that? Because people are a little worried about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, you know, that's a really interesting issue. You know, look at the things people worry about.
Right.
The truth is that, you know, I've been following this issue the last 2 years, and we sort of realized that we've been looking for the really big ones. You know, the so-called dinosaur killer scale asteroids, right? And civilization as we know it, and of course, you know, nobody wants that to happen. But, you know, an asteroid doesn't have to be that big to completely destroy a city.
Oh.
And if it's, you know, as we found out in 9/11, you know, it can have really major impacts economically. So there's a lobby out there that's pushing really hard for this improve our ability to find these. And there's two survey telescopes that are coming online in the near future, and they're going to be able to look at the entire sky, visible sky, pretty much every day, and find a tremendous number of these so-called near-Earth asteroids. And I guess the bottom line is you want to find it in time so that you can do something.
What would you do?
Well, one thing you wouldn't do is send six hammy actors up to a thing and drill a big hole in it and explode a nuclear bomb. I recently saw Armageddon again.
Yeah.
Film. Yes, that was very silly. You don't want to do that.
No.
Do not want to blow an asteroid out, because that'll turn a big asteroid into 10,000 smaller asteroids. So there's various ideas people are kicking around, and one that's really interesting is they would basically send a spaceship out and just park it next to the asteroid. And believe it or not, just the gravity of that spaceship would be enough, if it were far enough out, to divert the path of the asteroid. But we have to get it way out there. And there's been a few close calls where some big chunks of stuff came in, and if they hit the right place, it could have caused a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. So, why are we worrying about this more now, Daniel? Maybe we've worried about it before and it hasn't caught my attention, but we do seem to be talking about this a lot more now.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I'm not sure I can think of the actual moment when people started to think more seriously about it. It's been evolving the last few years, and some people in the space industry and astronauts and kind of worried about it. I guess about 10 years ago, NASA authorized a study to count the number of near-Earth asteroids over a certain size, and it's just gained some traction. You know, mm-hmm. there's an actual lobby now that's actively out there pushing for it, and we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. There's no program right now in place, and me personally, I don't know. I think it might be a good idea.
Let's welcome phone calls for you, Daniel. Daniel Pendick is our guest, associate editor of Astronomy Magazine, and their January issue has the top 10 stories in astronomy of 2008, and we're also talking about what they're looking at, of course, in 2009. Well, in astronomy, it's not just 2009. It's what's going to happen and land and show us pictures in 2011, 2015, and the years go on. So if you would like to bring up any of the stories that we've discussed or move us into – we haven't talked about all of the stories from 2008. Feel free to bring us into other areas. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. John Treader, our on-air producer, came in this New Year's Day, so say hi to him and we'll get you on the air just as soon as you'd like to join us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Daniel Pendick, our guest, our phone number 800-486-8655. And feel free to join us on this New Year's Day as we talk about the big stories from space in the year 2008. Getting back to Mars for just a moment before we go to our phone calls, Daniel. There's also, what's coming up in September, which will be a further assessment of Martian soils, past or present suitability for life?
Right. Oh, well, Mars Science Laboratory, the reason I say oh, well, is because the mission's been delayed. By another 2 years. That's a big one. Mm. I mean, literally a big one. That thing's the size of a small car. This is a really big lander. And unlike the Spirit and Opportunity that are still rolling around up there, this is much larger. Now, so you imagine we're not just taking a science laboratory and plopping it down. Now we take the lab and we can go different places. And it's got a lot more capabilities than anything else we've ever put up there. Mm-hmm. What happened was all the little devices inside of it, they call actuators, little motors and things that flip levers and move the arm, they had some problems with them. And it just got to the point where they just couldn't put it together. And they could have in the next few months, maybe. But unfortunately, we can only go to Mars every 26 months when the planets are sort of in a favorable position. We don't want to have to go so far that we can't carry too much fuel. And so they're going to have to put it off till 2011. Mm. But that should be a big one. I think if it lands and it functions, it's going to be able to do things we just have never done before. Mm. Science. Now, if you don't have a call, I mean, if I could backtrack to that supernova story.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I think the reason we picked that story as a top 10, besides the fact that it was a sort of a first, right? First time you saw the first moments of a star blow up. It's important to what they're going to be able to do with it in the future. Now, when they saw that X-ray, an initial flash of X-rays, that was they call it a X-ray breakout. That was the shockwave blasting out of the surface of the star as it was exploding. That's sort of a signal that we can use now. Mm-hmm. If we had the right type of satellite up there looking broadly across, you know, the whole visible sky, what happens now these days is when you detect an object like that occurs in seconds to minutes, automatically the satellites send messages down to the surface, and robotic telescopes, you know, this is without anybody's finger on the switch, they'll just slew over there and start observing them. And we've been able to do that a lot with objects called gamma ray bursts. But with this supernova now, this kind of holds out the idea that we've found the signal, that X-ray flash. And if we've got the right hardware up there, now we can start detecting, you know, dozens or hundreds of supernovae that before we might have got in pretty late, before a lot of the action was already over.
Mm-hmm.
That could be very important in the future.
What about this? I remember this story broke not all that long ago, I recall, which is on your list, that we discovered an alien solar system like home. That's a big story, isn't it?
Well, you know, it is a big story because, you know, the type of extrasolar planets we've been discovering, and by the way, I think the tally is up to about, if I remember right, the last number I saw was 334.
Goodness.
So the technique we've been using to find extrasolar planets is kind of biased in the direction of really big planets.
They're
very close to their star. And we can see the wobble, you know, as that big planet goes around its sun. We can sort of detect a slight wobble in the star. And it's pretty amazing, and we found a lot of really bizarre planets. But, you know, something the size of Jupiter with a surface temperature thousands of degrees, you know, orbiting close to the, you know, the distance of Mercury to the sun,
mm-hmm.
would sound like home, exactly. And I think what everybody's really looking for is what they call the solar system analog, you know, a solid planet, more or less the distance from Earth to a star, sort of like our sun. And that's where we would expect to find Earth-like life, right?
Sure.
So they used a very different technique to find this solar system I wrote about in the story. And that was kind of a big deal. You know, a couple of its planets were more or less in the same position as our planets, Jupiter and Saturn. I'm not saying it's like home at all. Its star is very different from ours. But sort of at the edge of discovery here. So when they see something like that, it gives them hope of finding, say, more Earth-like planets.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you imagine there's going to be a change in direction in the space program with a new administration coming in? Do you have a good sense of where this administration is going when it comes to space?
You had to ask me that one. Well, well, you know, I don't know if you realize there was a bit of a scare earlier in the campaign where position paper was floating around out there, and the rumor was going around that Obama was sort of looking to significantly delay the manned space program and take that money and put it into education. And,
right.
I mean, I think that's shifted a bit. Maybe he's realized that, you know, can't really do that. You know, but the thing about building spaceships is you've got tens of thousands of people, very skilled people, a lot of them very experienced people. And if you delay a program or put it on hold, they still have to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
So they tend to go off somewhere else. And you really lose your capability. The last things I've been reading is he seems to be committed to finishing this so-called Constellation program, the shuttle replacement rockets. And that's pretty important, though, because our last shuttle may take off in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to have our own way of getting people up into space for maybe 5 years. So we'll be relying on the Russians to get to the space station. That makes people a little nervous, as the politics of it is pretty unstable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So who knows what they're going to do? Hopefully they'll keep the core programs going, and we'll just have to wait and see what they do.
Right. We were talking about this the other day with guests who are long experienced in space exploration who talked about how much more we could learn just in a matter of seconds if we could actually have human beings instead of robots up there to look at what's there.
Yeah, that's a pretty thorny issue, you know. I mean, some very serious scientists have said, no, it's not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
It's too dangerous. You can do more. They'll say the exact opposite, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, you can do a lot more with robots for a lot less money. But, there, you know, there's another dimension to this that I think if you talk to the real supporters of human spaceflight, they see it as sort of a, an evolutionary step. You know, we really need to be out there pushing the limits and keeping people kind of engaged and excited. And that's a little troubling because then it just sounds like PR, right? And other people will say, well, if you didn't have a human spaceflight program, then people would just lose interest in the science. I'm not sure I totally agree with that. But that's we could talk for a long time about that one.
Sure. Let's take some phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the stories, astronomy stories that came to us from 2008 and what we'll be looking at in 2009. We start our calls with Rocky. Hi, Rocky. Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. Earlier this morning, a caller asked the host of the program if they could have a program about extraterrestrial life and information that our government and foreign governments are holding, not allowing the people to hear. I don't know myself. I don't have any strong feelings either way, but I was wondering if the guest has any opinions on just this sort of thing, extraterrestrial life and information about it.
Yeah, well, you know, we get a lot of mail about that. There's a lot of interest in that, certainly, and I don't know. It's what can I say? Some people will say sort of flippantly, well, yeah, sure, the government's going to keep a secret. You know, good luck with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there some, I think you're talking about, you know, the Area 51 people, the idea that we've got evidence, is that it? That we've got evidence of extraterrestrial life, but they're sort of sitting on it? Or
what do you think yourself? Are there little green men or not?
Well, I'll tell you what. Earlier in 2008, I did a story, you know, talking about the possibilities of life. And what is life? It got down to that. What do you consider a living thing? And again, there are serious people who have done serious studies and found that there are certain electromagnetic patterns that could exist in the rings around a planet, that particles of dust could be forming structures and exchanging information, and that by the rules, if you're open-minded enough, you can consider that life. So as far as intelligent life, I mean, the universe, the standard answer is, my God, it's so big, you know, millions and millions of galaxies, and it's hard to imagine there not being something out there that evolved, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as far as how we're going to actually prove that, you know, who knows? There's a number of stars that are close to our sun, but the closest one is still over 4 light years away. And with our current technology, we can imagine a building in the next century. It would take 10,000 years to get there. So that kind of raises the question, well, what if we did get a signal from an alien civilization? We'd never really be able to confirm it. We'd never be able to talk to them. I mean, faster than light speed works great on TV, but you know, we still can't imagine how we would do that. So it's a big, giant question mark, isn't it? But me personally, I honestly can't imagine, given the vast size of the universe, that there's not something else out there. And that just drags you into all kinds of theological questions that I'm not equipped to answer, to be honest with you.
That is so many galaxies, isn't it? Millions and millions of galaxies. It's just hard to take that in.
Yeah, and especially, you know, at the magazine, we work with these numbers every day.
Right.
And it just blows your mind at the scale of things out there and the number of planets that we're finding. And I should say that the whole extrasolar planet research, I think the big take-home message to a lot of people there is planets are not rare. You know, it seems like if a solar system can form a planet, it does. So that vastly increases the chance. And given what we know about the possibilities for things becoming alive, it's a lot broader than we think. You know, I mean, we find organisms on Earth that can live in the most unbelievably, you know, nasty environments. So why not out there,
True.
Too?
Why not? Thanks, Rocky, for the call. Sophie is next from Appleton. Hi, Sophie.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey there.
I'm 10, and I love science, and I want to know what to do to be an astronaut. Like,
all right, Sophie.
Okay. You have a question?
She wants to know what she can do. How can she become an astronaut?
How to become an astronaut?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of astronauts these days are coming out of the sciences. I think the ones that I know of, and this is not a subject that I know a lot about, but my understanding is that, you know, just about anybody can apply to go into the program, and some people are just pure scientists, you know, and other people come out of maybe a more aerospace background. Certainly they did in the old days. But, yeah, science is probably the best way in. I mean, the reason for putting people up there is not for a joyride, right? The hope is that by getting scientists out there in space or on other planets, they can learn something. So be a scientist and, you know, apply.
Mm-hmm.
You might make it.
Hmm. You never know when she gets to be of astronaut age what we'll be doing, right?
Right. We don't know. It's largely up to Congress, right?
Right. Thank you, Sophie.
You're welcome.
Have a good new year.
You too.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Barbara is next from Superior. Hi, Barbara.
Oh, happy new year.
You too.
I have a question. Living up in northern Wisconsin, we have, well, all over the world, the crescent moon with
mm-hmm.
a little star, and I always heard it was a north star, but I'm not familiar with that. But it is so beautiful, and it gives me a lot of comfort, and I'm wondering about the significance of that. I know the Turkish flag has that on their flag.
Oh, yeah.
Could you shed any light on that?
The crescent moon.
Bye.
Thank you, Barbara.
You know what? This is something is definitely punching a button in my head. I can't give you the details, but if I remember, is it Ramadan? Maybe there's somebody in the Muslim faith who can call in and enlighten us on this. But I believe in that faith, the Ramadan is time to the appearance, something to do with the moon, and it's astronomical. I guess they work on the lunar calendar, and that's not uncommon, right, in the old days. A lot of the Christian holidays, for example, were sort of timed to astronomical events. And maybe that's sort of a big picture answer is, you know, the sky was the only clock available to know when to celebrate certain holidays, when to harvest. And I'm going to bet that crescent moon has something to do with the Muslim scholars knowing when. I believe it's Ramadan. And if I got this wrong, I apologize to everybody for this. Maybe somebody will call in and let us know.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm sure somebody will call in. Our number, if you know the answer to that, is 800-486-8655. You always publish, which is a nice feature of your magazine, what to look for in the skies during the upcoming months. Is there anything that you go out and look at regularly in the month of January, Daniel?
Well, I like the planets. That's definitely my thing. And right now, there is something everybody can see. You don't need a telescope. It's pretty beautiful. It's Venus next to the crescent moon. It's very close in the sky. You can actually take a picture of it with your camera. And I'm just flipping through here our sky this month column, and there's some things coming up. You can see various planets, Mercury. These are things you need a telescope to see, though.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, in terms of astronomy, I used to work in a planetarium years ago. And one thing we used to tell people is it's just a nice thing to look up, to be more aware of the sky. And when you see those really incredibly bright stars like Venus, you know, look it up. It's easy. Just go online or look at our magazine site and just become more aware of the sky. Spend more time looking at the sky. You know, there's nothing spectacular, I wouldn't say, coming up. Certainly in the next few months, different planets will become more visible. But there's lots of places online you can go to find out about things like that. And even with a pair of binoculars,
sure,
you can see the rings of Saturn and, you know, just become more aware of the sky and spend a little more time looking at it.
Mm-hmm. because it's always fascinating. Even if there isn't anything really spectacular or new, it's always fascinating, isn't it? You get lost in it.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when you and learning some constellations, and I know it does seem to have a I don't know what you would call it, kind of a poetic effect on people, or you look up there and you start to put certain things in perspective, you know. I mean, not to get too philosophical here, but everybody knows the world's in not a great shape at the moment, and there's a lot of things to worry about. But, you know, the sky is huge and gigantic, and it sort of makes you realize that a lot of things that happen to us aren't in the big scheme of things. You know, they'll pass. It's not a big deal. Right. That's the way I take it anyway.
Right. Not a bad way to take it. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Daniel Pendick is our guest, associate editor of Astronomy Magazine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more of your phone calls now, and Don is next from Madison. Hi, Don.
Good morning.
Hi.
There is one thing that's faster than the speed of light, and we experience it every day. Your guest might be interested in knowing what it is.
What?
Human thought. We can imagine the entire universe in a microsecond.
Ah, interesting idea. That's right. Well, you're saying we can sort of think of the vast. Yeah, that's interesting. You don't mean literally moving fast in speed light, but
so if we think about time travel or space travel, in some sense, we already possess it.
Yeah, you know, and I should say that. Nobody's saying that faster than travel is impossible, or even time travel. You know, we've published stories about that, and you can work the mathematics out. So there's a lot of imponderable things going on even in cosmology today, ideas that are very hard to grasp and that are very outside of our sort of ordinary experience. So I like to keep an open mind. Nobody can say faster than light travel is impossible, but it's got some big challenges, let's put it that way.
Anything else, Don? Don is lost in thought. Yeah, thanks, Don, very much.
Lost in the pondering universe.
Yeah, right. Thanks very much for the call. Tina is next from Chicago. Hi, Tina.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good, thanks. So recently my husband told me that Venus and Jupiter were very bright in the sky. And actually, I think it was a week or two ago, I did look up in the sky and they look like very bright satellites. I wonder how frequently that happens and if you could tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, you know, what you were seeing is a planetary conjunction. And it was a sort of a little triangle formed by Jupiter, Venus, and the moon. And the joke was sort of on me because here I was one day, and I live in the Midwest, you know, not the most perfect place for stargazing all the time. And the sky was looking pretty good. Called somebody up. I said, "Hey, let's go to the bluffs before dinner and check this out." And literally, as I drove from the office home, I watched the sky close like a big gray curtain. I actually blogged on that, but. Yeah, we got a lot of pictures of that. It was really beautiful. Well, no, a conjunction is just depends on the timing of the planetary orbit, right? And without a table, I couldn't really tell you exactly when the next one like that's going to be. Hmm. But I wouldn't call them incredibly rare. I mean, I've seen a number of them in my lifetime. And again, you know, they're always worth looking at. There's just something about seeing those incredibly bright stars, especially against the sunset. That was a really beautiful one. But they're called planetary conjunctions, and you can, lots of sources online and in astronomy.com where you can find out about them. So, sorry, I can't give you an exact date.
Tina, is that helpful? Yeah, Tina's. Thanks very much for your call. What is the best stargazing place on Earth?
Best? Oh, boy. You get me in trouble here with the amateur astronomers. Well, the best places are places without clouds, places with clear, dry, steady air. There's places in Arizona that people say, as far as dark skies, would rival, you know, Chilean mountaintops, you know, places where they put the really giant telescopes for science.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately here, because of the prevailing weather patterns and the flow and the moisture in the air, it's sometimes difficult to find a really clear night. But it comes down to two things, you know, steadiness of the air, and, of course, just its basic clarity, lack of clouds and moisture. But if you really want to see dark skies, you're going to have to go to a place like Arizona. In fact, there's resorts and things where people are building retirement homes to live there, where it's specifically designed for people who are amateur astronomers.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I tell you, one of the funnest things about working at Astronomy Magazine is you deal with these people who have this just tremendous passion for this, lifelong, and they're doing, we call them amateur astronomers because they're not paid to do it. But they send us images, and they are just fantastic. The technology that's come along, and we publish them in the magazine all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Just absolutely gorgeous pictures that you could totally mistake for a Hubble Space Telescope shot if you weren't paying attention, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a tremendous number of people out there very passionate about this.
Oh, yes. And what about the Hubble? It's getting a repair, a final round of repairs. That's this year, isn't it?
Yeah, we should definitely mention that. That's another one of those classic delay situations.
Mm.
That story was in the 2008, you know, top 10, and at the last minute when they announced they were having problems with its communication system, we sort of axed that. But it will be going up a few months, and they're going to replace a few instruments and give us some more time on that. And that's really a... You know, I was sort of talking before about the achievement, right, of the Phoenix program. The Hubble, one of the NASA's so-called great observatories, you know, if you want to point to a success, you know, in contrast to tragedies like Columbia crashing and Challenger, that's one. I mean, it's just hard to exaggerate
right.
That telescope has done for our understanding of the universe. And so it's kind of nice. This is the last and final repair update. And then the next one is coming in a few years after that, much larger.
Hmm.
So the James Webb Space Telescope.
Hmm. But it won't be around until when?
I don't think anybody really knows.
Huh.
No, it'll be functioning at some level, and we'll see. You know, it'll be years, certainly, and as long as it's functioning and can send data down, the scientists will use it. But if something goes wrong, that's pretty much the end of it.
Hmm.
Just won't be able to go up and fix it again.
Right. Let's go to Ken from Cedarburg. Hi, Ken.
Hi, good morning. Just a little more information for Sophie.
Oh, good.
About becoming an astronaut.
Okay.
The NASA website, I believe it's nasa.gov, has a fantastic set of videos which are also available by podcast called Ask an Astronaut. And they're just a wonderful series geared towards the youth age group generally, but interesting for everyone that's interested in the topics. So just wanted to pass that along to Sophie and others who may be interested.
Wonderful, Ken. Right. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because just it's starting to sound like I'm on the payroll for NASA or something, but just to give another plug, I would say right now, depending on the website, but they have done just a tremendous job of putting a lot of the scientific knowledge in multimedia format. So you're going to see a lot of those podcasts and animations and videos and things, and anybody who wants to get an idea of what's going on, go to those sites. Guess I should plug myself, you know, astronomy.com.
Sure.
Before I forget, we have a feature called Ask Astro. So if anybody out there has any questions, you can just email them. That'll go right to me. And some of them make it into the magazine, some don't. But it's Ask Astro. This is one word.
Ask
astronomy.com.
A-S-T-R-O.
I'm sorry, A-S-K. Astro, A-S-T-R-O. Astro.
I'm sorry. Do it again. I'm totally confused. Ask?
Ask as in ask a question.
Right.
Yeah, ask Astro. This is one word.
Right.
At astronomy.com.
Okay.
Yeah, and we try to, you know, answer as many questions as we can when we can. do our best.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ken from Cedarburg. Let's go to Tobin from Madison. Hi.
Good morning. I heard recently that there's been no sunspot activity on the sun for the past several years, which is unheard of, is my understanding. And so my questions are, is that true? And if so, should we be concerned about this? And what is sunspot activity?
Right.
And I'll listen to your answer off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I can help you with that a little bit. Actually, what's happening is we're going into a new solar cycle. And about every 11 to 13 years, the sun goes through a cycle of increasing activity on the face of it, and then it decreases, just goes up and down, up and down. And we're, of course, early in the cycle, you're not going to see a lot of activity. But there's been some indications it might be kicking up. And no, there's really nothing to worry about. In fact, it's, you know, in a way, it's a good thing, because when you have very powerful activity on the sun, explosions and sunspots, you can sometimes, satellites can sometimes have problems because of the debris that flies off the sun. So, I mean, I remember at the peak of a sunspot cycle years ago, actually being able to see a spot on the sun. It was so enormous that looking through, or glancing through briefly, you know, a dusty sunset, you could actually see the spot on the sun. And, of course, everybody knows, don't look directly at the sun. Do not look through a telescope at the sun.
Right.
But basically, sunspots are just magnetic. It's related to the magnetic field of the sun, and it causes sort of a darkening on the surface. That's what they are. So, yeah, just wait, and the sunspots will be back, and it's not really an unusual thing. We're just starting a new cycle, so things are a little quiet right now.
Thanks for the call. We go to Paul from Duluth. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Kathleen, and thank you for wonderful New Year's Day programming today.
You're welcome.
I'll tell you, I've been a lifelong, I'm 58 years old, and I've loved looking at the sky ever since I was a kid. About, I guess it was 11, 12 years ago now, when the Hale-Bopp comet came by.
Mm.
Does the guest remember that? Anyway,
oh, yeah. Sure. Oh, yeah.
I was living in Denver at the time, and I knew I needed to get away from the city lights to view it. So I drove down to very close to the Colorado-New Mexico border. And I parked my van on some Forest Service grazing land near a extinct cinder cone volcano.
Mm.
And it was, I mean, I'd never been there before, and it was pretty interesting to look at. And so I got a view of the comet, and it was a totally beautiful night. And so after I stayed up till like 2 or 3 in the morning, and I crawled in the back of my van and went to sleep. And when I woke up the next morning, my car was surrounded by cattle.
Oh, my gosh. What a story.
Anyway, that was just my little story there. Here's something that's really kind of bothering me. I recently found out that CNN canned their chief science advisor, Miles O'Brien. And I really worry that we're going to, you know, people in this country are going to get less and less competent information going forward. And I wonder what your views are on that.
A lot of people are worried about that.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, it that's something a lot of people worry about. And that particular, you know, we're going through a period where, you know, there's a big change happening in the media. There's online versus print. And of course, the economic downturn, there's been a lot of people laid off. And I think they'd probably say, well, that's just part of that. I don't know if there's any larger trend of ditching science. But in a way, sometimes I wonder if science coverage is sort of like art class in high school or music class. It's the thing they toss out the window first when they want to save some money. And believe me, you know, the National Science Foundation is constantly pushing this idea that, you know, you need knowledge of science, you need an understanding of science. And I think a lot of people would agree with you. It's too bad they had to do that. But I would guess that it was more of a business decision than a targeting of science, you know.
You need more people in public relations for science and space, don't you think? Because these are huge stories, and they have profound ramifications for people on Earth, I think.
Well, sure. I mean, I think more than anything, it's, you know, I don't know, you know, I sometimes joke with people that, you know.
We have about 10 seconds, just
okay.
To let you know.
Well, I'll just, I don't think I have time to make
okay.
My point.
Okay. We'll have you on again so you can make it. Thank you, Daniel. Right. Have a great new year. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
Our guest this hour, Daniel Pendick. He's associate editor of Astronomy Magazine, and you can see some remarkable images at astronomy.com. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for coming into the station on this New Year's Day, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. I'll be with you again on Monday at 9, All Things Political, our regularly scheduled show. We'll talk about politics Monday at 9. Have a wonderful 2009. This is the Ideas Net.